Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. We will have a quick visit here with Robert Schock. He's the geologist who redated the Sphinx. You probably saw him in the Mystery of the Sphinx video and also the NBC documentary that had so many thousands or millions of viewers. Robert has written a new book called Voices of the Rocks. A scientist looks at catastrophes in ancient civilizations, in which he examines the role that catastrophes, both geologic and climatic, have played in our history. Robert joins us from Boston. Hello, Robert. How are you? Hi, Robert. How are you? Hi, Robert.
Hello.
There you are.
Okay. You can hear me now.
I can hear you now.
Okay.
So it's good to have you here. I've enjoyed talking with you over the years about the Sphinx and the redating. Is that pretty much sticking? Has the world at large generally accepted?
I think it's sticking now. I think... In fact, just recently, this is sort of the latest update on that, two other geologists, both British, have come out in print, not exactly agreeing with me on all the particulars, but overall confirming my work that the Sphinx is much older than dynastic times.
And for anyone not familiar with that story, just very quickly, you can redate the Sphinx because of the substantial amount of water erosion.
Yeah,
how do you get water erosion in the Sahara Desert?
Exactly. The water erosion, and then tying that in with the ancient climatic history in the area, there's just no way it could have been 2500 BC, you know, classic Old Kingdom dynastic times.
Unless they were just scrubbing that Sphinx every year or something, right?
I know, but actually, even if they were just scrubbing it, it wouldn't give exactly the type of weathering and erosion that we see.
It's torrential rain. I mean,
we all
know the corrugated look on the sides of the Sphinx from the differential erosion of various layers in the sandstone from wind, right, going sideways. But
right.
It's those deep rivulets. What's the deepest one, like 3 feet?
Oh, yeah, about 3 feet or more, actually.
Of deep vertical rivulets that you could just see water, you know, you can see the same type of erosion on hillsides where water just pours over, right?
Exactly, and you can see how they sort of V up, they open up toward the top.
Right.
So it's not...
waterfalls.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, and to get that kind of substantial, I mean, so the point is, it's not just the occasional rainstorm. It is torrential rainstorms. You didn't have that in the Sahara Desert unless you go back in time to, what, 8,000 to 9,000 years?
8,000 to 9,000 years ago. I date this oldest portion of the Sphinx at least 5,000 to 7,000 BC, so 7,000 to 9,000 years ago.
What's the oldest portion and why three different stages or however many stages?
Well, the oldest portion is what I call the core body. It's basically sort of the main portion of the body. And what I found through my studies is that was the oldest portion, or what was carved out first.
Yeah.
The head, which is clearly looks very dynastic Egyptian, and in my opinion, with good reason, because it was recarved. It was who knows what kind of head it was originally.
Well, it had to be bigger.
It was definitely bigger.
In proportion at that time.
Exactly, because the head is out of proportion. It's way too small for the body. So the head is new. In that sense, I mean, the head is very ancient by, you know, everyday standards, but it's not the original head to the Sphinx.
Kind of funny, because the Egyptian artists were known for their sense of proportion.
Exactly. Yet, I think, you know, they didn't recarve the whole body, in my opinion, because they knew they were working with something very old and very ancient and, to me, probably very sacred to them. But for whatever reason, they did recarve the head, and it got out of proportion. The other thing is that the very rump of it seems to have been recarved, the very, very end of it.
You know, I saw an early photograph of, I read the book of a woman who hitchhiked through from Britain to South Africa, the tip of South Africa, back after the war, so that must have been in the mid-40s.
Yeah.
And she has a couple of photographs that she took, and she's there with the Sphinx, and the Sphinx has no paws.
Has no paws in
no,
the
has no paws. Yeah, and I was going to ask you about that. Either they didn't dig down enough to uncover the paws, I guess, or, you know, those paws look pretty rebuilt, so
well,
I would say
that's a very interesting observation, because the paws, I mean, the whole Sphinx gets buried up to its neck in sand in about 20 years if it's left alone.
Uh-huh.
So it has to be dug out, and the paws are about the last thing to be dug out. But also, I'm convinced that what we see now is the paws. There's not much original there at all. And what you see in this day and age is a 20th century reconstruction, a late 20th century reconstruction.
Well, and it didn't start until after the 40s then.
That's right, yeah. So I'm not surprised, actually. I would suspect it's probably a combination of both. I don't know if I should say this or not.
Say it, come on.
Well, they continue to rebuild the Sphinx, you know, putting little limestone blocks in to rebuild it and fill in, you know, where it's been weathered and eroded, and you know, they're repairing it.
Yeah.
But what you end up looking at then is a 20th century
overlay
on top of the original Sphinx, and you can't see the original Sphinx anymore. I'd rather see the original Sphinx even in a bit weathered, battered condition.
Me too.
Than this 20th century...
Well, it's like any good antique. You want to see the original patina, and you don't
exactly.
want to see shoddy patch jobs. I mean,
exactly.
that devalues it.
Exactly.
In my opinion. But
yeah,
also
but
the Valley Temple. When we were there in Egypt with John Anthony West on one of his tours back in 96, he pointed out in the Valley Temple, which is right in front of the Sphinx,
right.
built of the same sandstone, also
right.
showing very, very deep weathering.
Oh, very
that,
deep.
That back in whatever times they had refaced it with other blocks, but
that's
you
right.
could go
in fact, yeah, that refacing that you're referring to, the granite refacing, was done apparently in Old Kingdom times, about 2500 BC.
Now, don't you wish, you know how they say in old houses, it'd be nice if somebody kept a diary of all the work and when it was done and
Absolutely.
Materials. Don't you wish that all these ancient monuments, somebody had kept the record so we could go back and see?
I sure do.
Date of Absolutely. Origin, first restoration, second restoration.
That's right.
Jeez.
Actually, that would go a long way towards solving a lot of the controversy.
Yeah.
Because, see, that's exactly what's happening in my... Some of the early restorations, about 2500 BC, they've been taken by traditional Egyptologists, I'll put it that way, as not a restoration, but the initial building.
And silly, really too, because you can see that it's a restoration.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, that's the interesting part, is that there are so many chapters of history missing because we're looking at the top layers,
right.
and we're not digging down below the surface, peeking underneath to those lost portions. And that's what's interesting about your work, because you're looking at the various catastrophes to explain why certain epochs, why certain historical records vanished.
Exactly.
We've got to take a break, but you have also just come back from a conference in Italy. I want to hear about that, and I want to hear how catastrophes, both climatic and geologic, tie in to our history. We know that if it's happened in the past, it's going to happen again in the future, so we also can bring this up to modern relevance in terms of how do we prepare and how do we get a sense of when the next one is. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show, and we'll continue our conversation with Robert Schock, geologist, just after these messages. I'm Laura Lee, and this is The Laura Lee Show. Robert Schock is our guest. His new book is Voices of the Rocks, a scientist looks at catastrophes and ancient civilizations. Important clues here contained in our geological record to what influences and what pressures past civilizations had to bear or were crushed under. Robert, recent conference in Italy where a lot of catastrophists got together and shared some research on an international level. Since we weren't there, would you tell us about it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it was an absolutely fascinating conference. Just to give you a feel for what it was about, first off, the title of it, and this is the English translation, the official English translation of the Italian title, was new scenarios for the solar system evolution and consequences in history of Earth and man.
That says it all.
It says it all. And it was organized by Professor Spedicato of the University of Bergamo, and it really went, it covered territory from, basically it was questioning the standard dogmas and everything from questioning the Big Bang, which, you know, so many people, I think,
we've had some of them on the show, and they bring up some very good holes to poke into that theory.
Oh, absolutely. So everything from questioning the Big Bang, questioning the history and makeup of the solar system, questioning essentially the history of humanity, and you were just mentioning, I think, earlier, you know, continuing discussions of the revisions, you know, revisions of early human history in particular. A lot of people getting together, myself and others, talking about catastrophes, natural disasters, how they affect human cultures, work on new interpretations of religion and the origins of religion, and how that might tie in with natural events. It's absolutely fascinating.
So what did you speak about, and who else was there, and what did they speak about?
I personally spoke about the Sphinx. That's why I was invited. And there was numerous people there. Just to mention a few, Professor Arp was there talking about cosmology and the Big Bang. And very
Halton
much,
Arp?
Yeah.
Halton Arp was there?
Yeah.
Oh, do you have a phone number? I've always wanted to talk with him.
Oh, yeah.
He's the guy that first suggested that there are some sort of links between stars, some sort of arcing.
Exactly.
And I understand that his, though he was a very well-respected astronomer, he got drummed out of the U.S. and went to, what, the Max Planck Institute in Germany?
Exactly. You've got it right.
Oh, man.
Oh, he was fascinating.
What did he say?
And clearly, I was super impressed. And he was talking specifically about the Big Bang, or, you know, problems with the Big Bang theory.
Uh-huh.
And how, you know, redshift and, you know, supposedly receding galaxies are probably not that at all.
Right. Because we're not the only vantage point, for heaven's sakes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, you get, you know, really good people, but they do something that's not quite conventional, and like you said, they just get drummed out in some cases.
How did you escape that?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I asked you that once, and you said something interesting. You said that to the geologists, the date of the Sphinx was no big issue.
Well, that is true.
It's
that
only
is
an
true.
Issue to the archaeologists because they have their pet theories about dates already in place.
Yeah, I think that's the bottom line. I'm coming from a field that, I mean, when I talk about it to other geologists, the general comments I get, which include in Italy, is, look, you've got a very good case. It's very interesting, but they don't quite, and I don't want to say they don't know what they're talking about, but they don't quite see the ramifications in the same light.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they realize the ramifications, but they don't care. It's not their
That's
turf.
That's not their turf, exactly.
It's not their turf.
By the way, the Great Pyramid is reopening. And,
yeah, I heard that.
And they're about to place at the Millennium, I understand, a gold capstone.
I've heard all kinds of rumors about that.
Now, what do you think of that? I mean, talk about, you know, 20th century restoration, I guess, putting that gold, much rumored gold capstone back on.
Yeah,
and
I don't know if it's 20th century restoration or just
20th century commercialism.
Yeah, commercialism and publicity. I don't mean that in too nasty a way, but
Well, tourism is down in Egypt, and they need to do something to bring it back, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I don't think putting a gold capstone on the pyramid is helping the pyramid particularly.
Yeah.
But it's probably helping other people.
It'd be interesting to see what it looks like. But so who else was at
conference?
Was
there. That was absolutely fascinating. Just to mention a few others, well, Victor Klube was there, another astronomer. I don't know if you know.
We've had him on the show, and he talked about how we're going to be going through an asteroid belt.
Exactly.
And we do so periodically, and so that could explain why Earth is battered and has catastrophes at various intervals.
Exactly. He was talking about those types of issues, which I think, you know, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think he's done incredible work. Again, someone who has not been
widely accepted?
I don't understand why he hasn't been more widely accepted, because he's done such incredible, meticulous, detailed work at all.
Well, it makes sense. You go through a universe, There are periods when it's relatively smooth sailing. There's periods where it's going to be a bumpy road because there's debris, you know, through the space through which Earth is traveling, for heaven's sakes. That's known.
I know.
What's the controversy? Does what do you have to say, and what do the various belts add up to what you've been looking at in the Earth's geological record of various impacts?
In fact, the amazing thing about the whole conference was I felt that so many of us were coming at the issues from different perspectives, different fields, yet we were all in agreement. We were all
arriving at the same picture, emerging
conclusion.
From the puzzle.
Because tying with Victor Kluge, as someone else, there's so many people to mention here, was a fellow who I'd not ever met before, really knew little about his work. His name was Mike Bailey. Actually, I think I mentioned him on the phone to you privately. He's a dendrochronologist out of Ireland. And he's been working on tree rings and never intended to get into any kind of catastrophism or anything else like that.
But the trees spoke to him.
And what he was finding was evidence of some kind of major disasters periodically that were showing up in stunted tree ring growth. You know, he could see huge frost levels. Were exceptional at certain times. I mean, something had to account for this, and his conclusion, tying everything together, is it's basically cometary events.
Cometary events meaning comets coming a little too close.
And actually landing on Earth, which ties right in with what Victor Kluge has been talking about all these years, ties in with conclusions I came to in my book.
Voices of the Rock.
Yeah, exactly. Which, of course, you know, I had to write and came out just about the time of this conference. So
let's talk more about this coming up with our guest, Robert Schock. I'm Laura Lee. Right now, let's continue with our guest, Robert Schock, geologist who redated the Sphinx. You've probably seen him in the Mystery of the Sphinx documentary on NBC, attracting 20 million viewers several times each in which it was shown. He's now come out with a new book called Voices of the Rocks, A Scientist Looks at Catastrophism and Ancient Civilizations. Robert, just before we take our first caller here tonight, the Chicxulub has now been pretty much accepted as the impact crater of the comet or the asteroid chunk that killed off the dinosaurs. So we can see it on a large scale. So what Victor Kluge and Mike Bailey and others are saying, well, it's not just the big ones, it's all the little ones, too, that affect us and affect climate.
Absolutely.
So you can't just expect big ones only. I mean, there's all degree to which, to the size of asteroids and comets that hit us. You look at the moon, you look at Mars, you can see the crater impacts because they don't have erosion messing them up like we do here on Earth. So what's the big secret? I mean, what's wrong with these people?
That's right. I don't know.
Why the resistance?
And I wanted to say, if I could, Mike Bailey, with his tree rings, he's now been able to get a series of dates for the last few thousand years. And if I could, I'd just like to read these quickly.
Oh, yeah, and then we have some calls for you. Go ahead.
Okay.
Series of dates, so this will explain a few things.
These are interesting dates, I think. Let me just read them quickly. And when I say these dates, you know, give or take a few years because, you know, comets impacts may occur over several years, but he's got one 3195 BC.
Okay.
If you think about it, that's the traditional origin of you know, the beginnings of dynastic Egypt, the beginnings of a lot of other cultures. And one thing I would speculate is, well, what came before them? What was wiped out?
Exactly.
That now you had sort of a blank slate and things starting over. Yet, as we know, especially with Egypt, all this evidence that it didn't just arrive, you know, it seems like, as they often say, dynastic Egypt just appeared full-blown.
Yeah. They say the same thing of Sumer, but Sumer happens to be sitting on top of 3 feet of a mud layer.
Exactly. But he's got this interesting dendrochronological comet date of about 3195 B.C.
I keep hearing 3100 B.C. as a date of some catastrophes. What's some of the other dates?
Yeah, another one. I'm going to do these coming up to the present, 2345 B.C., and that's approximately the end of the early Bronze Age, the end of Old Kingdom Egypt. There's a lot of things happening then.
Then
1159 B.C., which is the end of the Bronze Age, the very end of it, and that's well known. I talk about that in my book a bit, for the devastating catastrophes that have never really been well explained otherwise, burning of cities and whatnot. He's got one at 207 B.C., which a lot of things are happening in the Far East at that time. Also, you have the end of essentially Hellenistic
Greece
and setting the stage for the rise of Rome later. Coming up even more into the present, 540 A.D. was a major one, which ties in with the final collapse of the Roman Empire, the beginning of the Dark Ages, etc.
Uh-huh.
And then we've got 1178 A.D. There's an event there, which actually Professor Spedicato has documented, and that ties in, of course, with Crusades, and especially in the Asia, with a lot happening as far as Mongol invasions, that type of thing.
Right, because you start invading your neighbors when your own food supply gets cut short because
exactly,
the plants
exactly.
aren't growing.
And by this crude chronology, and this is something people like Victor Kluge have talked about, we're due for, in the next century or two, for another...
episode?
Yeah, another episode, if we could say that. And we may already see the beginning of that, both with... I'm sure most people are familiar with Tunguska in Siberia in 1908, and then with Shoemaker-Levy, which fortunately did not hit the Earth, but hit Jupiter.
Well, Jupiter's gravity well would suck it in, wouldn't it, given a choice?
Just a few years ago. So we may be coming in for another episode, because it does seem to occur in approximately, 800 to 1,200 year cycle.
Charles is in Merced, California. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you this evening?
Good, thanks.
I got a question. Something struck me a while ago. I saw a show on Discovery Channel or something. It was about Central American or Mexican pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, there was all of a sudden it just jumped off the screen at me. There was looked like sphinxes, miniature sphinxes or smaller versions of them guarding one of these temples.
Uh-huh.
And, it looked exactly like what you proposed the original Sphinx may have looked like 10,000 years ago or whatever it was.
Really?
Is there some relationship? Have you ever seen this or heard of this?
But To be honest, I have to look into that. This was this in Mexico?
It was either Mexico or Central America. I can't remember.
Mexico
it's probably been
Central
in the last
America.
Year or two that I saw it on one of the Discovery Channel shows or something like
that. Wow. One thing I will say, something I take very seriously, and a fellow by the name of David Eckhart was at this conference I just came back from. He was making a very strong case for ancient contacts between the Americas and the Old World.
Diffusionism.
Times. And I'm you're probably familiar that there's actually a lot of evidence for that.
Oh, indeed.
I have another question.
Go ahead.
Do you know who, I got the wrong name possibly, a Russian man named Velikovsky or something?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the first place I've heard of this where, as a disaster, as a trigger for different events in human history.
And it's funny because Velikovsky, I guess it was Worlds in Collision, came out about
1950
or so and was just, the way academia took it at the time was just horrendous.
Well, did he write that? Was that in the 40s or what? I don't know the time frame of his.
Yeah, I think it was. He wrote it in the 40s and it was published in 1950.
And he was probably laughed out of
town.
He was totally laughed out. But at this conference, in fact, there were a couple of, if I could call them, Velikovskyites, who were arguing his case, and I would say a number more. And I would put myself in this category at this point that would say, well, maybe Velikovsky got a lot of specific things wrong.
Well, his mechanism.
His general concept of major catastrophes in the time frame of human history and their effects on human history, I mean, you have to take that seriously now.
Well, could you speculate on one more really far out thing?
Go ahead. Sure.
Do you have any thoughts one way or the other on alien intervention in the human species?
I'm glad you brought that up. Thanks.
Yeah. Actually, Alan Alford was there. I don't know if people know his name. He was at one point advocating the sort of the same types of ideas as Zachariah Sitchin, which I think is the type of thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
And he has now reversed his position on that. Personally, I don't have any opinions on it. Well, I shouldn't say that. Personally, I do. My opinion is that I don't see adequate evidence for it.
Yeah, it just seemed to me like a fascinating possibility.
But I think it's a fascinating possibility. I was actually talking with Alan Alford at length about it.
When we went from one kind of species to another and another and another, and finally when Cro-Magnon man, popped up out of nowhere, it almost seems like it was a directed kind of a genetic experiment or something.
Yeah.
It just seems fascinating possibilities. But
oh, yeah.
There's so many people who are looking to revise early history because so much more data is now available to us in a forensic sense.
And
it's going to be interesting to see the evolution of these theories that are just theories now.
And about the early, very early human history like that, what we're finding is, I mean, certainly whether there was alien intervention or not, certainly was not just a progression from, Homo habilis to Homo erectus to Homo sapiens. It's now known that these species overlapped in time. Some of the Homo erectus might be as recent, if the dating holds up, as 35,000 years ago, versus Homo sapiens being 200,000 years ago.
And that they interbred as well.
And that they, the story was so simple maybe 20 years ago, it's not simple anymore.
Yeah, it's almost like Future Shock. We're afraid to find out more information.
I think we're eager to find it out.
But the religious leaders in the world may not be.
Yeah, that's true.
I got an interesting letter from somebody reacting to Lawrence Gardner, and they said, well, we know all that, what he was talking about. It's just that we choose to believe that God wrote the book anyhow. So that was interesting that they're even accepting some of the historical data. They're just choosing to interpret it differently.
Mm.
So will you please call back and let my dad interview you, Charles, and find out more about why you listen to the show? You know a lot. You've been following these topics deeply.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little bit out of the mainstream of the general public. I like things like this.
We take all types. Thanks so much for the questions and comments.
Thank you.
Let's talk next to Blue Max. He's in Berkeley, California. Hi, Blue Max.
Hi, Orly.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Slowly adapting to the new cyber world.
Ah, yes. What's your comments, questions for Robert Schock?
Well, I don't know much about the, about the Sphinx, but I guess my questions would have to do along the lines of the locations, the geometric relationship between the Great Pyramid, the three pyramids there, and the Sphinx. I mean, does it look as if when they were all finally installed that they, whoever built these things said, these are going to have some kind of, relationship to each other, or is it more or less happenstance that the Sphinx and these pyramids just happen to co-reside in that area?
Interesting question.
A lot of people have done a lot of work on that, and the virtually unanimous consensus is that it's not happenstance whatsoever, that the Sphinx and the pyramids are very carefully aligned to one another. The Sphinx itself sits on the eastern edge of the Giza Plateau, absolutely due east to the second pyramid, sometimes known as Khafre's Pyramid. The way the sun comes up and, then sets on the solstice, et cetera. I mean, it seems that it's a very, very thought-out, planned arrangement.
How far back do you think, Robert, the pyramids go? Because the techniques, especially with the Great Pyramid, don't relate to the other building techniques
that you don't see.
Is that not a clue?
It's a real problem as to who built the pyramids, when, that type of thing. I mean, actually, that's something I had a chance to discuss with several people at this conference, too. I believe that the first major structure on the Giza Plateau was the Sphinx, that really set the stage for everything else. And I think that the pyramids and the other structures were aligned relative to the Sphinx and not vice versa. I personally think that when we look at the Great Pyramid, the Second Pyramid, today, we're seeing primarily, the first thing you see visually is primarily dynastic. But I also believe, and I have good reason for this, looking around at the pyramids and finding geological evidence, that they are built, the current superstructures are built on older structures.
Oh, tell us about that. Bluemax, if you have further questions and comments, stay on the line. If you have a question as well, better call in now for Robert Schalk at 800-800-5287. Earlier structures than the pyramids themselves, that really falls in line with other pyramids around the world, particularly in Mexico, where they kept rebuilding them over and over.
Exactly.
Egyptians themselves kept rebuilding, tearing down and rebuilding the same thing. So why not the pyramids? What do you think was there? We'll find out just after these messages. I'm Laura Lee. We continue right here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest, Robert Schalk, redated the Sphinx, and now he's comparing past catastrophes, both climatic and geologic, as in asteroid impact, to the demise of various civilizations. Robert, you just put on the table that you believe that there were even earlier structures where the Great Pyramid series sits today. What do you think was there originally?
To be honest, I'm not sure what was there, but what I found when I examined the pyramid is that around the base and within them, I'm convinced that there's something going on, that they are built on some kind of earlier foundation. And actually, my personal opinion, and based on the data I've been developing, is that the second pyramid may have actually been the earliest structure on the earliest pyramid-type structure in the Giza Plateau.
What are the clues for that? What are the clues for that?
Basically geological, the same type of evidence I've applied to the Sphinx. When I work around, you know, examining the base of the second pyramid, you can see where in parts it's been quarried from the original rock on the Giza Plateau. There's constructional techniques that seem to be predating dynastic times. The mortuary temple, it's sometimes referred to as the mortuary temple of Khafre, because the second pyramid is referred to Khafre. That mortuary temple is actually built in two different portions. One seems to be, like the valley temple, much older than the other portion, and seems to tie in with what I would, in a crude sense, call Sphinx Age.
You know, that's so typical of those pharaohs, because in order to make their, put their stamp on things, such a macho thing to do, they went on these building sprees, and how better and how to save money in your coffers than to appropriate other buildings and add on them, or even statues. I'm convinced, I saw in the Cairo Museum a lot of statues that had to have later dates put on them, because it was very different techniques where some hieroglyphs were written than how it was carved. That was obvious, and cruder hieroglyphs than what the carving technique was. So you know they're two different periods. And, you know, we keep antiques around. So did they, for heaven's sakes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
so that,
I think there's no question. So getting back to the second pyramid, so-called Khafre's pyramid, which I think is a real misnomer, it seems that there was something there that he appropriated unto himself. He also took a temple that sits due east of it, which he then added on to and turned into his mortuary temple, and that both of those early structures, the what we could call the proto-mortuary temple and the proto-pyramid, seem to have been associated with the Sphinx.
Oh, boy, how interesting. Yeah. So will we ever find out what was beneath them?
I think we will if we can get the Egyptians to cooperate.
big if. There's a precedent also in even the cathedrals of Europe, where there's been first a natural spring or a grotto or a low cave, and then they started to build temples to Mother Earth, and then over there became cathedrals, right? Once a sacred place, always a sacred place.
Yeah, once a sacred place, even as religions change.
Yep. Also, they found beneath certain Mexican pyramids that there were natural springs or caves or something. I think that's true of Teotihuacan, the theory goes now. Or a series of seven springs, I've heard, with some of the Teotihuacan structures. So, oh, how interesting. You're the first person I've heard tell us that there might have been earlier structures where the pyramids sit now. Keep us posted.
That's pretty new. I mean, it's developing.
Uh-huh. Thanks for sharing that one.
Absolutely.
Miriam is in Fresno, California, with a question for you. Hi, Miriam.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
I was wondering if your guest has heard of the pyramids that were discovered on the bottom of Rock Lake in Wisconsin. a team of archaeologists and geologists, along with the author Frank Joseph, discovered them, and they determined that they were there thousands of years before America was ever discovered.
You know, I've had Frank Joseph on talking about those, and they're pyramids in the sense that they're kind of conical shapes of stones, right? Kind of conical stackings of rocks. But Robert, good question, because there are lots of interesting structures right here in America.
They're definitely interesting structures in America, and to be honest, I don't know anything more about them than what you just said, because I haven't had a chance to examine them myself. But they're definitely interesting structures throughout the Americas. I mean, I'm convinced that some of the structures that we have, I live in, I teach at Boston University and live in New England, and we have all these strange stonework structures that conventional historians say are colonial root cellars, that type of thing.
Which
makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And they seem to, many of them seem to have affinities to, for instance, megalithic structures in the British Isles, Celtic structures, etc.
So very early works. And diffusionism could come in and explain how those various cultures got to America to build them,
exactly.
Right?
And I think that what we're going to find over the next 10 or 20 years is that diffusionism at a very early point in time is going to become more acceptable, should we say, academically.
Yep. Miriam, thanks so much for bringing up those rock pyramids in Wisconsin. Appreciate that. By the way, the Radio Bookstore has a number of interesting books. It has Frank Joseph's book on those pyramids of Rock Lake. It has Robert Schock's book, Voices of the Rocks, A Scientist Looks at Catastrophism in Ancient Civilizations. It has the video, The Mystery of the Sphinx, and much, much more. So you might want to give the Radio Bookstore a call or get online to them, radiobookstore.com. Or call them and ask for a catalog at 800-243-1438. Last question, Robert. Also we've got to put on the table here in terms of interesting American structures, earthen pyramids, looking very similar to those in China, mm-hmm. very similar to those in South America. We, however, tend to call them ruins, not temples.
Right.
And who knows what got plowed under by early colonists who thought they were the work of the devil or something, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, unfortunately, our country has a long history of that.
I know, we think of our history going back to 1700. Well, it's a much longer history than that.
Right.
Yeah. What do you want to say in 2 minutes by way of conclusion? I want to, first of all, thank you for the visit and thank you for all the work you're doing, and do keep us posted on your work with the proto-pyramids.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I don't know. There's not much I can say in 2 minutes. I think we're in a very exciting time right now as far as really revisiting the history of Earth and the history of humanity.
You know what else is exciting is that, sure, the fringe has always been interested in this stuff, but look at you, a tenured professor of the stature at Boston University. Look at Victor Klub and some of the other folks that you've mentioned. This is all becoming academically accepted now.
Exactly.
Why? Because the evidence is there. You've got to follow the evidence and the story it's going to tell you.
Evidence is absolutely there. I mean, 10 years ago, I don't know that we could have had a conference as we just had, the one I came back from. It was sponsored by academic institutions.
Yep.
The evidence is there, and we have to follow it.
Well, I just want to say that's why we get various researchers, whether they have a degree or not. That doesn't matter to me. What matters is that they do their homework, they come up with some interesting theories. That it's true or not doesn't matter to me. How are we supposed to judge the truth and the infancy of some of these? That it makes sense, that it's intriguing, and that it's opening a window to new possibilities. That's what makes the difference for me. And
I absolutely agree.
It's been a pleasure over these 9 years we've done this show to look at various researchers, to give them a first shot at presenting some of their material, and then the academics get it. I mean, we've talked about diffusionism for years and years and all the evidence piling up. One of my favorite diffusionists, Gunnar Thompson, still isn't getting to the mainstream academia world that he wants to. They just don't want to hear it, but that's changing. But Recent Time magazine was showing all the various evidence for cultures coming here to North America long before that 12,000-year-ago land bridge. So it's happening, isn't it? And Robert, you're part of that wave of academia accepting and looking into and furthering these theories. So thank you so much for that. Check out Robert Schock's book, Voices of the Rocks. I'm Laura Lee. This has been Conversation for Exploration, and I want to thank you for joining us on our tour around the universe at large here tonight. And join us next time. I'm Laura Lee.